Hey, what's up? This is John Wysocki from Lydia's Castle, and you're listening to Music City Metal.
Hey, this is Tom Hazard, and you are listening to Music City Metal.
Music City Metal, Larry Mary in the Fishbowl for our second episode of the year. I don't know. Was it 2.5 because we did this bonus episode?
I think it's 2.5, yes.
We got another bonus episode coming up here.
Lots of bonuses this year.
I don't know. We're changing things up. We're trying something new. What do you think?
I like it.
Bonus episode.
It's good.
John Wysocki coming up. Phone call. Like one of those off-the-cuff phone calls that we just record.
Does he know that? Is it candid phone call?
Yeah, kind of. I said I wanted to talk about the podcast, and so I kind of like left it open-ended, but we'll see. We'll see how it goes. It's going to be how it is. I'm going to do it soon.
It's going to be how it is.
As long as I survive tomorrow. That's all I have to say about that.
Oh, I think we should do a podcast about survival.
Yeah. How are you?
Who, me?
Yeah. What did you think of the Weird Sisters last night?
I honestly liked it. I was overwhelmed with how many people showed up.
No kidding, right?
Man, and no some kidding. Of those people like were digging through my closet from 1992. What is that about?
It's like,
get rid of those clothes.
Yeah, no, last night was a really good look into the Nashville underground music scene, which includes the style of music we heard last night, which was very psychedelic, very EDM-ish, clubbish, right? And the metal scene. There were a lot of people that we see at metal shows that were at the Weird Sisters.
Yeah, there
were
some punk rock kids hanging out.
And I just think it's the underground scene is just a thing. And it was nice to see people. And there was a lot of ham and eggers, like the clubbers and the, you know, the trippers and mm-hmm. the, you know, a handful of trippers, handful of, you know, the club scene. It reminded me of Florida, you know.
The girl
the
with the
ecstasy.
Pink hair.
Yeah, the girl sweating and their makeup running because they did too much ecstasy, you know.
Probably.
But it was a good representation of the underground scene in Nashville, not the Broadway.
Oh,
scene,
yeah. You know. But is it really underground anymore?
It's becoming, well, there's still an underground element to it.
Which means what?
Just the alternative looks, you know, a few people that look like Halloween for several people.
Mm-hmm.
You may have thought it had been Halloween night.
Mm-hmm.
They still go in and out of the woodwork. You don't see, you know, I still think it's an underground thing.
You think that one girl with the red, foofy, feathery thing goes to the grocery store that way?
Maybe. But I, you know, some of them I think save it for the weekend, but man,
I thought the music was really great, and apparently their family members, perhaps their parents or someone of the elder category, came out because they were looking at me like they thought I was part of their little group of old folks. Don't judge me by my hair color, please.
Well, you know, hey, I'm salt and pepper beard here.
I thought it was
about
cool.
5 inches going
Grandpa
down my
came
chin.
Out. That
no,
was
it was
cool
nice.
To support
it was nice.
His perhaps grandchild
it was
or
cool.
something.
I enjoyed it too. That's the funny thing is when we were putting together the first Fish Fest, the reveal who has played at every Fish Fest, we were pulling bands in and, you know, getting bands to play was very easy. Like we had more bands that we can handle. And Dusty from the reveal suggested, dude, you gotta get the Weird Sisters. They're new. They're just like up and coming. And here we are 5 years later. And, you know, they had a good crowd.
Well, up and coming no more.
No
that
more,
was a
yeah.
packed house yeah. at the Vinyl mm-hmm. Lab
no
Lounge,
kidding.
Whatever it is.
Vinyl. Well, the Vinyl Lab was
The lab
the
was pretty cool.
I love
was
that
mesmerized
place,
by,
the way.
That through the window.
I have fallen in love with that venue.
For real?
No, the yes. Yes, I just, you know, like when we first moved here, Exit Inn was it in the end for like we would go there a lot. You know, Exit Inn is still there, but it's not the same place it used to be.
No, it's not. But what is Rob? Rob calls that guy Gary Smiles, Gary Sparkles, Gary something. He calls
Sparkles, Gary. Yeah,
the guy at the
end. Oh, good luck. I was trying to get a gig at the end. It's the same.
I'm sorry, I couldn't help
no
it.
No cash, no cards, cash. Hey, you know what? He's the only one. I don't know. You know what? He's smart because
he
you hire people and they steal from you. So right. He's the owner. He handles it all.
Yeah.
Guy's always there cracking the beers open. You know, there is like there is something about the end people like, because Demon Hunter sold out two shows right in a row within hours.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, a band that did pretty good at Brooklyn Bowl.
Mm-hmm.
And that we've seen at you know, bigger venues, like people like playing there for some reason.
Because it still feels underground to go right back to what you said in the beginning.
Mm-hmm.
There's something about that feeling of, I only put this outfit on the weekends.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know. That just makes you come alive.
Very good. And with that, I think it's time we move on to part two of our conversation with Tom Hazard.
Well,
where do we leave off?
I reckon that we had a little ghost in the machine. So we kind of start in the middle of a thought.
Yeah, we left off with him. You know, we're like, you kind of like, hey, we're at an hour, so we should wrap. And he kind of.
Then he got all pissed off
with
at
us
me
a little bit. What, you got somewhere to be? Got something to do? And then we're like, okay. And I just said,
I was trying to be polite.
I'm like, all right, two episodes then. And then we just went on, well, for another hour and 15 minutes.
We
so
did.
Check this out. This was during Snowpocalypse here in Nashville in late January. And today it was 60 degrees. Yeah.
Love it.
Snow's gone. Yeah.
Love it.
But part two of Tom Hazard, a lot of stuff coming up in the next episodes in February, and talk about Fish Fest. We're going to have some announcements to make, and very excited with where things are going. Here now is part two of our conversation with Tom Hazard and THC Records, Music City Metal.
Finding it, you know, has always been an outlet for me. You know, anybody who's ever heard anything I've ever written, you know, whether it's for myself as an artist, as it's for another artist that I've written songs for or produced, I mean, it's, you know, for me, you know, since I was a little kid, listening to music has been an outlet, but writing and making it too, you know, I mean, metal, I think it's, yeah, maybe not so much in the 80s. I think as it progressed in the 90s and got a little more real and serious, and the subject matter got a little more serious, and artists like Nine Inch Nails and Soundgarden and you know, Chris Cornell and Pearl Jam, I think a lot of artists started bringing more realistic issues to light. And I mean, that's when we started talking about mental health. And really, I don't think prior to that anybody talked about it. I mean, look, I was in, you know, I got locked up on my first mental health vacation when I was 13, you know what I mean? And, you know, by the time I was 14, I was on another one, and then beginning an addiction and then sobriety journey. And I think that ties in pretty heavily too. A lot of the people, you know, do drugs to self-medicate their depression or their bipolar disorder or their, you know, anxiety. And I think those things really a lot of times go hand in hand, you know, trying to just self, and it did for me, it always has, you know, any addiction I've ever had has been, you know, be it physical, be it mental, has been about trying to either build my confidence and deal with, you know, the lack thereof, or self-medicate the voices in my head, for lack of a better word, you know, and I think those the issue of mental health really does go hand in hand with the addiction discussion, you know, for that reason, you know.
Exactly.
As somebody who's dealt with addictions my entire, I'd say my entire adult life, but even as a fucking kid, as a teenager, you know, it started as rebellion. What starts as rebellion turns into self-medication and a coping mechanism, and then, you know, kind of generally comes full circle where it starts to have a detrimental effect on your mental health, and it just becomes a vicious fucking circle of, you know, like a dogfight of addiction versus sanity.
Right. Well said. Very well said. The self-medicating, and some of these, you know, some of the artists that we did lose, some of them, a lot of those were taking prescriptions too, which you see that as a side effect. Yeah. It, you know, just forget about the, heroin. I mean, we know fentanyl, what that's doing now, 200 a day, 192 a day. That's what they're saying. Done.
Yeah.
So that's even a whole new generation. It was kind of like the heroin. But yeah, when that music changed in the 90s like that, and that's what made me fall in love with that. I mean, even the new metal and then the grunge.
Oh, yeah. Was,
they were singing about angst, and they weren't talking about sex, drugs, and rock and roll. It was like,
and look, there's something to be said for sex, drugs, and rock and roll.
80s, 90s, right.
Yeah. There's something to be said for it. It was fun. I mean, I think the 80s, there's a just a different kind of fun to that music, and it's a little more of like a party atmosphere, you know, it's a little more of an escape, you know, from reality. But as the topics changed in music, I think, and the shift happened, I think that music kind of helped you deal with reality, you know what I mean? It like helped, it was more, hey, this guy can relate to this. I can relate to this. This person understands what I'm going through. Where again, I think they're just two different dynamics. The 80s, sex, drugs, and rock and roll was just an escape from reality, where this was more identification with the artist and with them going, holy shit, yeah, I feel like this. This guy feels like me. That's, you know, and to me, as a writer, that's why I fucking do it, man. That's why it's so important to me. It's in my DNA, because it's like, I always feel like I have stuff to say, and you know, and it sucks. Cause I mean, a lot of the shit I put out with Allison, Sleeping Giants and Civil Truth and Hammer Comes Down and whatever the fuck, it's all cool. I think Hammer Comes Down was lyrically, I mean, look, they're all cool, but that's fine. Sleeping Giants wasn't what I do. You know, it's funny. That was like one of the first songs I've ever written that wasn't immensely personal. You know, it was just kind of political thing. And that was sort of where DMC was coming from with it. So I just kind of rolled with it. You know, I didn't know how to write a song like that. I don't really know how to write thrash metal songs that are just, you know, I don't know how to write Iron Maiden songs. I don't know how to write songs about politics, or, you know, I guess if I write a song with a political message, it's kind of buried in a more personal message. It's a little more ambiguous. I'm not ever so straightforward, you know, with it, you know? So, but I've always, to me, part of why I write is just to get things out. And when you can get things out and people can identify and take something away from that, I think that's the most powerful connection you can have with another human being. And I think that's part of the allure of being a rock star, especially for my generation of kids who grew up. I just think there's this whole other generation who grew up on different music and on fucking drugs and on pharmaceuticals and fucked up in the head. And I think there is a more abusive generation and just a lot more damage, man. I think my generation grew up a lot more damaged than, you know, in different ways than any generation in history. And I think we just dealt with it a different way and kind of learned to, again, a different kind of damage, but we also came up with more constructive ways to sort of deal with it. I think in the past, in the 50s and 60s and 70s, people just drank, man. You know, people just drank or beat their wives or, you know what I mean? It was,
sure.
I think our generation was one of the first to figure out how to find more healthy ways to deal with their anger and express certain emotions. I think part of that was through more aggressive music. You know, hey, there's no secret that in the 70s and 60s, there wasn't any fucking heavy metal. There was no Metallica. There was no Slayer. There wasn't this style of music to take your aggressions out. There wasn't mosh pits. There was nothing, you know, so people got in fights. There was, you know, again, there was just no healthy outlet for aggression prior to like the fucking 80s, man, you know?
Right.
And then I think we started developing more healthy outlets for depression and for other negative emotions that really weren't there before. Or it just wasn't talked about. It just wasn't dealt with. You were just a troubled kid, or, you know, it was like autism, man. Or, I mean, there's people who were autistic, or even people who were just like dyslexic, who were like, oh, they're fucking retarded. Let's put them in a special class and they're dumb and they'll never be anything. Like, because they didn't know how to deal with it. They didn't want to. I mean, there was a time when if you had depression, they just locked you in a sanitarium and say you were fucking nuts and dumped you full of
too close
drugs so you couldn't function. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what they did with teenagers back had problems, you know? And so I think just as a society and as a generation, we found healthier coping mechanisms and healthier in certain ways, but then in certain regards, the opioid epidemic and, you know, certain things.
The opioid epidemic, yeah, I was part of that. And I was post-surgical, you know, when they're spitting out, you know, OxyContin like a gumball machine.
Like a Pez dispenser.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, I was involved in all that. It was just so money-related.
I'll tell you that.
Tightened up so much that they're not even, now they're not taking care of post-surgical patients well enough after surgery.
Not.
Because they've gone so far the other way that, you know, that there's no balance now. They were given way too much. But these people, I have friends doing heavy surgery and, you know, 3 days supply, and that's how long it takes the fucking anesthesia to wear off when they're sawing into your bones, you know, having back surgery. So, yeah, now they're just gone the other way with it, too. But it was horrible. Yeah, they were throwing it at you. It's, yeah.
Oh, yeah, dude, I remember I had, when I was 30, so this was 18, 19 years ago-ish, I had my first death, so I died for the first time. I had a staph infection in my throat, and they misdiagnosed me for like a month, like to the point where I died on the table, and they revived me, and then I basically came to and they said, well, we don't know if it got into your bones. So if it did, you're still going to die. Come back in a month and we'll tell you. But so for that first 3 weeks, I was sick. So first I went to the hospital saying I was having pain in my neck. And they said I had whiplash. First they said I was seeking drugs. I'm like, no, I'm fucking not. I'm just in pain because I couldn't find anything. And then I went back. Again, and then they just gave me drugs. And then I went back 2 days later, they gave me more drugs. And then I went back and I couldn't swallow anymore. So they gave me liquid Vicodin. That was their answer. Wow. By the end of this, towards the end of the 30-day period, I finally went into my doctor. By that point, I couldn't move. I had to be wheeled in the wheelchair. I couldn't turn my head. I couldn't move my upper body. I couldn't wash myself. I couldn't shower. I literally went and grabbed my doctor by his lab coat and said, I am fucking dying. If you do not figure out what the fuck is wrong with me, I am going to die. Literally, he's like, oh, let me try this. So he went and did a CAT scan, which they had never done before, and saw that I had my entire chest cavity was filled with infection from here to here. And this was on December 23rd, the day Christmas Eve Eve. So I was immediately put in for emergency surgery. I had a tube this big coming out of the hospital for a month with a tube coming out of my chest, sucking all this infection out of me. It was just awful. But at the end of that experience, I had a drawer full of opioids. I never really took that many of them, so I still had them. And it was crazy, the amount of pills. That's all they knew how to do was just throw. Oh, the Vicodin's not working. Okay, here's oxy. Okay, the oxy's not working. Here's morphine. you know, here's this, you know. And then again, when I couldn't swallow, I went and I couldn't swallow pills, and it turned out my throat was so full of infection that by the end of it, they said by the time they found it and operated on me, did the emergency surgery, I was breathing through a hole in my throat that was half the size of a straw. Within 8 hours, they said my throat would have just closed up and I would have died.
Wow.
So,
incredible.
But again, and that was sort of my introduction. I never liked opioids. And through that experience, I really didn't like them. So I never really got into them, thankfully. But I've watched so many of my friends, you know, I've worked with a couple guys who were junkies, for lack of a better fucking term. And it unfortunately was their ending, you know? And
yeah.
It's a really... And I've seen a lot of them that came from this opioid epidemic where, you know, again, it started like you. Like, they got on pain pills after a surgery. And then they just got so addicted to them. But then they ripped them away and they started making them hard to get.
Yeah.
You know what they did? They started doing heroin. Because heroin's easy to get. And then the heroin started getting cut with fentanyl. And fentanyl was easier to get. And now everybody's fucking dying and... Yeah. You know,
yeah, that's exactly it. And you spelled it out. It's a sad number.
You know, and it really does. And the, you know,
192 a day. Yeah, fucked up.
No, yeah. I mean, look. And I worked with Chuck Mosley, the original singer from Faith No More, and he was unfortunately a heroin addict, and he got clean, and I got him clean, and I tried to help him stay clean. And he was clean for a couple of years, and then he relapsed, and he died. You know, and the problem is, and even when they get clean, they go back and relapse, and they think they can still do what they used to do. Or they get something that's cut with fentanyl, so it's 10 times stronger than what it was. Like,
oh, yeah.
So
it's just, you know, I love those guys so much when they were out.
Oh, me too.
Goodness gracious. I knew he struggled with substances for a while, but I thought he did get clean for
good.
That's
what he said.
Yeah, he did. I thought he said he relapsed. Yeah.
No, he did, and then he relapsed.
He relapsed.
Yeah.
And then he relapsed, and it killed him because he got a hot dose, or it was laced, or whatever it was. His tolerance was gone because he'd been clean for a few years.
Yeah.
And that's what happens. You know, your tolerance goes way down, and then you think, oh, I can do what I did before.
And the stuff is way stronger, the fentanyls.
Yeah.
We knew some police officers that they found somebody deceased in a vehicle and picked up the baggie, the paper, and the wind blew, and it got in the corner of his eye. And a police officer collapsed that way and had to be Narconed because...
Narcan?
Yeah, Narcan.
Narcan.
Hey, look, this is an epidemic the fish man has. I mispronounce perfectly easy words. It's giving people
salsa.
A lot of
it's not salsa.
I know.
Salsa. Had
a good voice pronunciation thing.
Uh-huh.
But yeah, no, that stuff's strong and it's sad. And again, a lot of those, my start with opiates were my dad had a brain tumor. And he was terminally ill, and long story short, like right at the end of his life, I started toying around with his pain medicine because I saw what kind of he got in a good mood when he took them. So my start with it was not because I just had surgery and had physical pain, but for the buzz and for the, it was medicating trauma that was going on all around me, nonstop. And so then I kind of stopped doing that. Once you get in the clubs, then it becomes cocaine very quickly and easily. But then I had the back, 20 years later, I have this major surgery that went wrong. So now I had a legit excuse to be prescribed heavy doses. It was OxyContin and Percocet is what I was taking. It took about a year and a half before I was literally... chased by, a big crash.
A hot mess.
A big crash and burn,
Literally.
Wow. 90 days in jail, yeah. But
that's how it
chased by, oh, yeah. But it was all that. It actually changed my inside out, but you know, my brain. I just did. You just don't even become the same person on too much, you know.
But it does. I mean, it changes your whole brain chemistry. It changes your whole body chemistry. I mean, it's, you know, and the fentanyl. I mean, that's just, it's just this next level. You know, but again, it all comes back to, I mean, a lot of it ends up being self-medicating. Again, but back to the suicide thing, the mental health thing. I mean, I was telling you the other day, I mean, I've had a lot of friends, you know, that have passed either from suicide or from drugs, one or the other. And, you know, there's an epidemic. There's a couple epidemics. Number one, the opioid epidemic, which morphed into the fentanyl epidemic because they let it. And a mental health epidemic. I mean, it's so hard to get any kind of mental health treatment. There's still a stigma, especially as a man. As a man, I think there's still a huge masculine stigma to therapy, to treatment, to those sorts of things that, you know, I think is, you know, I think as men, we were, and especially, and there are certain generational things, but I think our generation was taught, I know me personally, I was taught men don't have feelings, men don't cry, men don't have problems, men don't do shit, men are stoic, men shut, I mean, you know, I don't think my kids have ever seen me fucking cry. Like, maybe once or twice, and like a couple times ever, like, holy shit, really? Like, again, I have a very hard time showing affection, experiencing affection. I grew up without a whole lot, and I don't have real close familial ties. It's just, you know, whatever. It's my cross to bear and my baggage. But I think that's kind of a generational thing where, you know, latchkey kids and our parents were the first generation of doing drugs and kind of certain things, and it was still okay to beat the shit out of your kids then. And, you know, so I think we grew up with a lot of abuse and a lot of negative situations and a lot of neglect and a lot of, you know, I think we're also the first generation to really try and reverse that with our kids and do better, which I think is great. But again, mental health is 100,000% hereditary. I mean, both of my fucking kids are nuts. I love them, but I'm nuts. Their mom's nuts. They're nuts. My mom's nuts. My, you know what I mean? Like, it's generational and it's hereditary, and it's, again, all we can do is try and be better and lift the stigmas. And look, and I know, you know, I've, you know, dealt with suicidal ideation since I was 10 fucking years old. So have my kids. So have a lot of other people, you know. So, you know, I lost, and I told you this story the other day. It's really hard to talk about, and I don't even know if I should, but three of my friends who I worked with a band, who I was friends with from high school. We all moved out to LA together. So one of their guitar players was actually my guitar player. He ended up joining the band to replace the other guitar player who left. And he was my guitar player, my band, and one of my good friends. And we all moved to California together. And then there was falling out. And sort of some of us still talked, some of us didn't. They moved back home to Wisconsin. I stayed there, some stayed there. But in the last 4 years, three of the guys from that band have committed suicide. And three of them. And the last one was just last year.
Wow.
And he was, you know, and he was, the last one was, and I had just reconnected with two of them right before, man. Like, one of them, I had just reconnected with him for the first time in like 10 years. A month before, we started hanging out, and he was hitting me up and trying to hang out, and I was too fucking busy with work and my stuff and my kids and my life and that, and he took his life, and that was really hard to deal with, the grief of the guilt, and fuck, why didn't I go hang out with him? Maybe he needed me. Maybe that was a cry for help. Maybe that was, you know, I had no idea why. I didn't even know he was depressed, you know, and I knew he had some disturbances, you know what I mean? And we talked about that, but, you know, you just never know. And literally, we reconnected, we hung out a couple times, and a month later, he was gone. And fast forward 2 years later, and I reconnected with Chad, who was the other guitar player who joined the band as the replacement for the first guitar player who took his life, his own life. And the third guitar player was my best friend when we were young and we were in a band together. And we just reconnected a couple of years ago, and I found out he was doing a drug thing, and I didn't really know there was an issue there. But me and him had just reconnected and started talking, and he's like, dude, come up, let's work on some music, let's do some stuff. We were sending some stuff back and forth, and he lived like 40 minutes away from me, but I was so wrapped up in my life and everything that just happened with David and that whole shit and COVID and just trying to get my life back that we didn't really get to reconnect. And then he was gone. And it's the same fucking guilt of, was it a cry for help? Was he, and then when you go back and you look at those messages they sent and, the conversations where you're too busy and you're like, oh, I'll hit you up later. And then it just takes on this more sinister tone, like, fuck, man, you look back and you see all the stuff that in your head is like an obvious cry for help. Fuck, why didn't I go hang out with him? You can't blame yourself. You can't. But of course you want to. Even Chuck, when Chuck overdosed, man, he reached out to me a few times and we just hung out. Man, it's just like you always, when you're close to that and you have a relationship to that and those things happen, you tend to take it on yourself and internalize it. And especially when you're someone like me, like I said earlier, I'm not great with emotions. I'm not great with certain things or sharing them. Or, I'm a manly man and we don't talk to people. We don't talk about it. So again, you internalize all this shit and then it becomes just part of your burden and then you're fucking, So yeah, it's hard, man. It really is when you get into those situations and the guilt and all the things that come with it, you know what I mean? And stuff.
Yeah,
and again, it all adds to it, man. It all adds to it,
It's definitely part of that process when you are up close to a suicide, whether it was a good friend or like our situation, it was our roommate, friend, and, we found him in his vehicle. And boy, oh boy, when it happens like right under your nose and like living with the person, like, you're like, what did I miss? And then, then you kind of look back at those last couple of weeks, and it was very hard not to go through my own guilt too.
What did I miss? What could I have done? And, right, how could I have stopped this?
And what interesting, when we were cleaning my friend's stuff out of the garage, we were, he was a contractor, and on one of his 2x4s amongst his belongings, it just said, spend time with a broken man. And boy, did that have some impact on me, because I knew like there was some little message there. And we were friends, but he became very withdrawn. And the last thing he wanted to do with Mary and I was watch House of 1,000 Corpses with his like 4-year-old daughter. And I was still having trouble with my dad's death, and I couldn't watch horror movies. So, that was the last thing he wanted to do with us, and we didn't. And you always feel bad, like, damn it, maybe a conversation would have happened, so the guilt, it takes a while. I don't know about you, Mayor, but yeah.
I think that comes with part of that, and I assume he was about our age and from our generation. Part of that, I think, comes from that programming that we can't talk about our feelings and we don't know how and we're not equipped to deal with them. And,
he was young. Again, he was actually wanted to be, and it was silly. He was in a goth band, so they were always darkness anyway, but he made a joke.
Yeah.
I'm going to be in the 27 Club, when he was young, right? He'd just make crack jokes about it. But he did. It was on his 27th.
It was before, before.
Really? A week before, yeah. Yeah, that was the one that we found. I know. So he had some darkness in him too, man. Again, mental health. He really did. He'd just gone through a divorce and left a beautiful she's married now, isn't she? Yep. His daughter.
But again, there's so much stigma attached. Yeah.
But anyway, that's why we do what we do. And
I think the metal community is generally cool about talking about it. There's no judgment, and I'm fucking depressed, man. I'm having anxiety. There's a little bit. The metal community's always been good about being able to talk about
it. But I don't think those conversations happen. I mean, they're really in my world. They don't. You know, I don't call up my friends and go, "Hey, dude, I'm really fucking depressed." I don't. It doesn't happen. I've had people who I've had these conversations with before, but generally it's when there's some kind of drug crisis going on. I don't know about you, but me and my buddies gonna call each other up and talk about our feelings.
Like maybe you guys should. That's what I'm hearing
The young generation now does. I've had a few people reach some young men in bands wanting some mentorship, but dealing with either mental health or newly married. The ones that are in their 20s are doing that. But yeah, Gen X, were you considered boomer or X? You're X.
Oh, definitely X. I'm 48. Right.
Yeah, okay.
What? He's my age.
Yeah.
We're young.
I'm the old.
You're the old guy.
The old guy.
Yeah, but I'm 48 going on 70. So.
He's an old soul.
I definitely think
the younger generation has been better at it. I think part of that is we've been good at lifting the stigma about it, but there's still, you know, here's the thing. A lot of people that, and I've always talked about this, man, I mean, as a thing, like, and as a rule, and it's like, when you really are suicidal, you don't fucking talk about it, because here's the thing. Here's the double-edged sword. If you talk about it, people say you're looking for fucking attention and it's not a legitimate suicidal ideation. It's just an attention-seeking behavior. So, but sadly, the people that, you know, at least in my generation, we were coming up, and I went through. I was in mental facilities for suicide attempts and for these kinds of things, and depression, and manic depression, and bipolar disorder, and all these mental health disorders. And that was kind of the prevailing thought process of just, if you're talking about it, you just want attention. You know what I mean? But really, I mean, I think people who really, really, really are hell-bent on killing themselves don't talk about it, because they just don't want anybody to fucking stop them. And it's the whole thing about it, you know?
True.
It's such a...
The ones that succeed generally don't talk about it.
Usually you have no fucking clue, and that's part of why it's so shocking, because it comes out of fucking nowhere. You didn't even know it was in their thought process, you know?
I don't know. The metal community is cool, and it is an outlet, I think, a lot for emotions. We were doing some research and just reading about it for other show topics, and especially like what happened during lockdown and the good parts of music and how it is therapy, like some of the statistics of the people that learned an instrument during like COVID lockdowns, right? It was insane. And some cool bands got together too. Some amazing music was written. So a lot of people that did have music as some kind of outlet in their life, whether it's building the event or whatever, you know, doing all these different aspects of the business that you do, besides, you know, an artist themselves, being a part of that. And it was therapeutic to a lot of people. So we haven't gotten as far to have statistics, but that's coming up in some of our other episodes. But wow, we might have to break this into two parts.
I think so.
That happened.
Yeah.
One interesting thought that just kind of got triggered by that. I think part of the support, and again, the younger kids are better at it. You know what I mean? They are. The younger kids are better at it. My kids are better at it. They're so much better at talking about this stuff. And again, I think part of the stigma is lifted, and that's where I feel like we've done better as a generation to equip our kids better to deal with this shit, even if we can't do it. You know, but I think some of the support in the metal community is unspoken. Again, I don't think we're not like talking to each other like, yeah, bro, I want to go fucking blow my head off. I think part of it is people helping people through music. What I was saying before about that experience of writing something that somebody can relate to, I think part of the support comes from that. I think it comes from the actual music. It's a more unspoken support than a literal support. You know, I think people listen to things and that can pull them out of dark places. The fact that they can hear something in a lyric and relate to it and be like, okay, this person feels like me. I think that's a bigger part of it, you know, at least for me historically, but I think there's more of an unspoken level of support actually through the music than through, you know, people actually talking about those issues, you know?
Yeah. The younger kids have some resources again. You know, things that help mental health, like I have a couple meditation apps when you get a moment, you know, doing events sometimes was super stressful. You'd have five things going wrong at five, you had seven events that day. And it was sometimes, you know, just live events, shit goes wrong, and it was very stressful. But I started doing meditation breaks. And, but you know, that there are things out there we never had.
I thought you were going to say I started doing meth.
But I'm sorry.
I thought you were going to say I started doing meth.
Oh, oh yeah. Meth. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Just on Sundays though. No,
well, it is Sunday.
That was, that's one thing. There are two drugs I can say that I never touched. Not many, but it's meth and heroin. And I would have been dead had I touched. I stuck with the opiates. And
yeah, I can say I haven't touched one of them.
Yeah. I was too scared. I was petrified. I was really, really scared of doing the drugs because, I mean, I was even like the first time I went through rehab, I met some people that did both opiates and heroin, and they're like, man, we would take an OxyContin over a bag of heroin any day. It was more potent. So I'm thinking, I've already done that drug, but if I ever were to touch that, I would just have been dead, you know, because it was dangerous.
The thing is, heroin,
I just never.
They're similar.
Yeah.
They're similar, just like meth and Adderall. I would have overdone it.
That's what I'm saying. I knew I would have.
But just like meth and Adderall are really similar, but. Oxy is pharmaceutical. Well, Oxy is pharmaceutical. The dose is controlled. Heroin's all over the place. You don't know what you're going to get. You know, that's why it's more dangerous. You know what I mean? It is the same, a very similar chemical compound, but you don't know what the fuck you're going to get in that bag of fucking heroin. You know what you're getting in that OxyContin. You know what I mean? Which is where it's more dangerous. And I kind of feel, but yeah, me personally, I've never met a stimulant I didn't like, but. You know, besides right. that, I never got into opioids. I was never really a fan. I don't know, man.
Yeah, that's a good thing. Well, I'm allergic to them now, and that's a whole nother story.
Thank God.
for small favors.
Yeah,
I get a pretty bad reaction from the alpha gal if I take them, unless it's an injection. No oral. Anything oral, man. Yeah, I have terrible allergic reactions. Sick as shit. But, shots are okay. I have gotten a few shots from the back. Hit DR a couple times a year. My back gets bad enough. But anyway, no more scripts for that for me.
Y'all, how old are we?
I found some natural things. I use cannabis and this other thing called kratom. And, there are days it's a leaf and it's a crushed leaf. I take it. It helps with the pain, and it's not an opiate, but it's getting people off opiates with no withdrawal and not having to go to another drug to get off of.
That's
them.
Great.
So, yeah, it's a plant. You know,
a lot of people keep pushing kratom on me. The singer Matt, the singer from I Set My Friends on Fire, is a big proponent of kratom too, and he's always. Like, dude, get kratom for everything. Like, I broke my foot, get kratom.
Mm-hmm. Wait, did you hear what he said? I know we just came out of like a heavy subject, but did he just say, I set my friends on fire?
Yes, the band, I Set My Friends on Fire.
Where have they been all my life?
They've been around for like 20 years, so I don't know. Apparently, you just missed them. They're great.
They're kind of like a metalcore.
Yeah, they're kind of like a big punk metalcore type band, kind of more pop punk metalcore. They were signed to, I think their first record was on Epitaph. But yeah, no, I kind of worked with them, and you know, they played a couple of shows with Taproot, and so the main guy in the band is a cool dude named Matt, but he's a big Kratom guy. He swears by it.
I think it saved my life, truthfully, because I was.
Oh.
It did save your life. You want to know why it saved your life?
Why?
Why do you think it saved your life?
Oh, well.
Because it kept me from killing you.
It kept. And or leaving.
Which would have killed you probably anyway.
You know, we're like, it's just. But it did. No, it just. There was no withdrawal symptoms. And I didn't. You don't feel high or anything when you take this plant. But you just feel normal. You know what I mean? It's like it has caffeine, coffee-like properties, like energy. And then there are leaves that are in the red strain that help for people having anxiety attacks. You know, Mary, you've a couple of moments where we're at a gig and you've taken a couple Kratom pills. But that's the red vein, and they help calm you down. So, yeah, no complaints. He can overdo anything. I mean, I've heard about people doing an insane dose to try and match a heroin high, but that's not the point of this. It's a very mild opiate banger, you know, what they call opiate analgesic, but it's very, very mild how your body interacts with it. So
I was just kidding. I never really wanted to actually.
We've talked about there's a couple Kratom bars. Kratom bars.
You never really wanted to actually kill him.
I just wanted to set the record straight. No, that what?
I wouldn't have blamed. Hey, I don't blame you. I don't. There's a couple of times I wouldn't have blamed you.
I may have wanted to pack your bags.
We've made it, man. So we met.
We did. High five.
I met her at a wedding, and here we are, 23 years later. She's got a great voice. She's good at this. Doesn't she have a good voice? You think your voice? Yeah.
He's going to sign me. I'm going to get signed. I'm just kidding.
To audio books.
Look at his face. Yeah. I'm kidding. Yes, I'm going to be your. I'll read your book. I can be your audiobook reader.
Right. Good one. Yeah. I made you guys order my book. You're like,
we did.
You said you had David's other book. I'm like, you know, the fucking one I wrote with him. What the fuck is wrong with you?
So yes.
I made them order.
Now I'm not going to get it.
Meeting is over until you order my book.
Amazon's not probably going to come out here in the country this whole entire week. So now my book will be delayed.
Yeah. Amazon's right down
there. I'm sure not going out there. That's for damn sure.
Well, we appreciate you trying.
Well,
I did try. I gave it the old college try. Awesome.
But, man, thank you for this. After being driving all freaking day like that, you spent the time, and I'm looking forward to what we're going to talk about and maybe see what we'll get to announce and do some work with you this year, man. But
definitely.
What's like to wrap up, like what's one of your big goals, or what would you be happiest if you achieved this year with the label or business?
I don't fucking know. Surviving.
Horizon, more writing.
Surviving.
Living to see 2025. We'll see.
Okay.
Yeah, I know. There's a lot going on.
There always is, man.
Got music.
You know, every day is a blessing, and every day I get to spend with my kids and my dogs and working and still getting to do what I love. And, well, thank you guys. This was so much fun. I'm going to go finally relax and watch some TV and probably pass the fuck out. I got to get up and drive 10 hours tomorrow. So thank you guys again for having me.
It was a good conversation, though, man. Just
this was
really
awesome.
You shared
thank
some
you.
Nice stuff.
Hey, do you want to make the world a better place? Commit a random act of kindness to a complete stranger.